All right, thanks very much for joining us on episode 5 of the Unknown Strength podcast. I'm your host, McGregor McNair. With me, as always, is Brenton McKitterick. Unfortunately, Steve Phillips couldn't join us tonight, but he'll be back with us next episode. On this episode, we have a super special guest, Mr. JT Tenacity, James Tomlinson, who's a strength and conditioning coach for some of the best Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fighters in Australia. He's also a personal trainer, a competitive BJJ brown belt himself, and an all-round legend who I've known for a few years now. So have you, right, Brenton?
That's right. I've probably met James maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, I reckon, probably when we were back in blue belts through the jiu-jitsu scene. So yep. I've had the experience of seeing you on the mat and cornering you and being cornered by you and pretty much the full experience.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I was like back at down in Balaclava, right?
That's it, yep. Kaizen Fitness, William Street.
Yeah, that was cool. That was a bit of a throwback, but that's, yeah, it was an awesome time.
Awesome. And so, JT, before we get into the thick of it today, I just wanted to touch on something that not a lot of our listeners may be aware of, but you were actually a personal trainer for Fitline a few years ago, and that's how we first met.
Yes.
And I remember you being at the top of the pile of Fitline trainers.
Yep.
And that was when I'd just come in as a fresh-faced manager up here at Fitline Myers Place.
Yes, yeah, slightly less beardy and possibly not as muscular or as strong at that time. I do remember. I do remember first meeting you at that time, Mac. Yeah, Fitline was very good to me coming to Melbourne and being able to be a personal trainer in the Rialto. And I think, you know, at its zenith was awesome. It was probably the best PT studio in Melbourne at that time. So it was such a good place to be then and be amongst such good trainers and a good vibe and, you know, good community. So, yeah, it's cool that we got to meet like that. And here we are now.
Mm-hmm. Here we are.
And, yeah, it's kind of a bit different. I'm coming in as the guest to be on the very soon to be very well known strength podcast.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
With your help.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So why don't we just get straight into the good stuff? And yep. Why don't you tell us about your background as an athlete in the martial arts? I understand you started with Taekwondo at a young age and then you moved on to BJJ and recently you've started your amateur career in MMA, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, funnily enough, pro career. But not to worry, it's one of those things that once you get a certain level in martial arts, it's difficult to get amateur fights. And so I, probably just a little bit impatient with the process, was like, okay, I'll take a pro fight, which was probably not the best idea, but that's all right. Like, from a learning experience, it was good. And, yeah, I think the challenge is now, because MMA is so popular, a lot of people are getting into it probably too quick because they really want to fight.
Yep.
I think it's something that, like, everybody wants to do. If you love martial arts, you want to know if your skills stand up. So, yeah, I think it doesn't matter who you are, whether you've got 10 years experience, 1 year experience, whatever, you want to know if you can hang. And you want to know what that feels like. And definitely, I think we all need to be patient and not jump in too quickly.
Absolutely.
So on that, obviously being a brown belt, does that offer some kind of, that obviously offers some kind of barrier into entering the amateur market of MMA, given that, you know, if you've been a brown belt, generally you'd expect anywhere upwards of 6-7+ years worth of jiu-jitsu training. So finding an opponent, I understand, would be quite difficult.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. That was like the biggest issue. I definitely would have loved to have had an amateur fight. And yeah, I should have waited, but I didn't. And yeah, it's funny, people, I think when you get to a certain level, people assume certain things about you. But if you already have a black belt in martial arts and a brown belt, and then that was just like a bit of a, I don't know, a deterrent or something. But yeah, it's just one of those things that I think, because MMA is such a demanding thing, I think people don't appreciate that, you've got to be good everywhere.
Yeah,
and right. A brown belt in one martial art doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, when a brown belt gets punched in the face, you know, they're a purple belt, right?
Is yeah. Well, I don't think that's entirely true. I think a brown belt getting punched in the face is still a brown belt. You're just annoyed they got punched in the face. So, you know, you're still going to get armbarred real hard. But, you know, you can even just see off the recent fight, Robert Whittaker and Jacare Souza. You know, Jacare is honestly, you know, he's a GOAT. He's one of the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But you cop a shin kick to the face, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're not conscious, even if you're still standing up, you're done.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in my humble opinion, Jacare should have been the champion 3-4 years ago. So
I totally agree.
Yeah.
You know, arguably, at least in my opinion, the best middleweight at the moment. It was the best middleweight, and now it's all up in contention. So a huge win for Robert Whittaker.
Yeah, massive. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that was incredible. So why don't you rewind, go back to the start, and tell us how you got started with Taekwondo and the martial arts.
All right. Well, because that's the thing. I feel like I've told this story a couple of times, but anyway, we're here now. So I was actually a pretty chubby kid, and I wasn't good at sport. And as a result, I got bullied a fair bit in school. So... yeah, hit a critical point where I just said to my mom, I want to learn self-defense because I was just getting beat up all the time. It was just a super regular thing, and it was killing my self-esteem. So my mom took me along. The local school hall had Taekwondo there, and I went there. And anyway, it was like the second day of class, they taught us this self-defense thing. It was a very traditional school. And it was like a foot trip with a bit of a chest shove. And it was meant to be that initial confrontation when people are shoving in the chest.
When you say foot trip, you mean kicking at their feet to trip them, or are we talking grapple?
You kind of catch almost like a foot sweep, and you push them at the same time,
right,
and it trips them over.
Okay.
And that gives you opportunity to escape, run away. And my teacher at the time, Andrew Johnson, he had studied Wing Chun as well as Taekwondo. And this is a bit of a Wing Chun move he combined with some Taekwondo. Anyway, it's funny because we just practiced it over and over and over for like half an hour. And he's like, you know, you've got to stop the confrontation before it starts to punching. And so funny. 2 days after we'd done this, classic bully scenario. This kid called Chris Wilson, school captain, house captain.
The jock.
Really good at sport, really good runner. And I sucked at sport, right? So he hated me. Because we're in the same house. We're in Lawson House. And so I was always bringing the team score down because I couldn't.
What color is Lawson House?
Yellow. So I couldn't run and I couldn't anything, you know what I mean? So he hated me for how crappy, how nerdy and chubby I was. But anyway, so he came up and it's pretty terrible because it's almost like Harry Potter scenario. He always had like two guys with him. They always had like hanger-oners, you know? And they came up and he's like, you got something for me, Tomlinson? And I was like, nah, man. Like, we were pretty broke. Like, I had, like, a tuna and, you know, celery sandwich. Like, no one wanted to trade sandwiches with me. It's always healthy, multigrain. No one wanted it. And anyway, they came up, and he shoved me in the chest. And I was like, oh, I'm going to catch a beat down again. But then I was like, oh, light bulb moment. And he, like, shoved me in the chest again. I was like, oh, snap. And I was like, okay, I just had this little moment where I was like, I do nothing, I'm going to get beat down. I'm going to try this thing. It doesn't work, I still get beat down, but I got to try this thing.
Go
right?
down, fighting.
So he shoved me in the chest, and it was just like timing. Like I just like did the move, I kind of shoved his hands out the way, caught his heel and pushed him, and it was like nailed it. You know that moment in the film Snatch where Brad Pitt gets KO'd and he just gets horizontal?
Yep.
And he lands, he just hits the ground, he goes into the water. Like, I just absolutely leveled this guy out. He hit the ground flat on his back and he was winded. He was just like, and I was like, oh, damn. Like, I just went, I just leveled up. I just turned into like the fat child Hulk. Like, I just got massively swole. And his mates are like, oh, shit, oh my God. I think this kid knows karate. Like, they were trying to like pick him up and he was just like winded. And I was just like, it was like, changed my life. Like, it was like knowledge applied. Like, I wasn't physically stronger. I didn't get fitter in 2 days.
Mm.
I just knew something and I applied it and it stopped me from catching a beat down.
You executed a technique at the perfect time, the right opportunity.
It was fluke, absolute fluke. But because I did it, it saved me and I became obsessed. I started training like 6 days a week.
So like, how old were you at this point?
I was 10 and a half.
10 and a half. So year grade five.
Yeah.
Towards the end of primary school.
Yeah, which just like, it was actually end of grade four coming into grade five. But man, and that just got me into martial arts. And then doing sit-ups and running and all that, like related sit-ups, push-ups, all the classic martial arts stuff. It was amazing, you know. And that really started the change in my the trajectory of, you know, my life.
Absolutely, that's awesome. And so I imagine once you hit teens or even beyond the teens, like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was getting more and more popular.
Well, look, I think honestly it didn't really come onto my... Okay, it did come onto my radar briefly. Like I'd forgotten about it. But when I was doing Taekwondo when I was about 13, 14, I got my black belt at that time. I'd grown dramatically. I was about as big as I am now, but maybe about 14 kilos lighter, but I was pretty much fully grown. And my mates had put on a VHS tape with, you know, the early UFCs. Like, right. Oh, look at this. Yeah. You should do this. This is sick. You know, and I was like, I don't know. I was a bit of a like hothead at that time. I didn't mind getting in fights or confrontations in high school, just being insecure. But seeing the early Hoist Gracie stuff. I saw it and then it went away and it wasn't really in my mind for the next couple of years. It was only much later, like more than 12, 13 years later, that I actually came across Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and it registered. So,
how did that exposure resurface for you in your life when it came to Jiu-Jitsu?
Well, like I'd had a long time in Taekwondo and I'd kind of been deep in it and I had a short break and I came back to it and I'd been fully immersed in it. And I'd moved to Melbourne when I was 21 and I trained almost full time for about 4 years for Taekwondo, trying to compete at a international level, like national level and then international level. My goal was to try and make an Olympics, but that didn't happen. And like in all, you know, truth and perspective, I wasn't good enough. Like I wasn't on that level. I didn't have probably the technical level, yep. Even though I'd worked really hard at it. I was trying to do a sport, which is a decided advantage is having long legs.
Yeah.
I got real short, stubby legs.
You're a stocky dude.
So that wasn't like the
You're
best. That
built
wasn't
like a kettlebell.
Yeah. Similar, very similar, probably slightly shorter legs than a kettlebell. But, so then I just stopped because I didn't achieve what I wanted and I'd broken up with my girlfriend and I kind of stopped my job. I'd stopped working at Fitline at this point in time and it was not long after that I started doing kettlebell training. And then I started doing some work for the Australian Kettlebell Company. Mm-hmm. But it was a strange thing. I was living in St Kilda. I'd moved to St Kilda and I was walking around St Kilda.
With kettlebells?
Well, it was one of those things that
I don't know.
It's funny. I saw lots of people carrying all these like different colored gis, like wrapped up in the belt. I was like, dang, what is that? Because like, we just have white, like the white kind of
Taekwondo.
In Taekwondo. And so people wearing black gi, like they had black. And I saw some guy had like purple. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? And I went up to Wolfie. Who's a guy from St Kilda, like Peter DeBean, St Kilda. And I said to him, man, what do you do? He's like, oh, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I was like, what is that? Like, what is that even as an amalgamation of words? Like, I wasn't a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It didn't seem to make sense. And he pointed me towards DeBean, St Kilda. And I went up, I just went up the stairs. And there was Big Mick Wilson, just gi off, ripped, muscular as hell, like steaming, like just finished a roll, steaming massive hero muscles and just eating a massive thing of broccoli, chicken and capsicum, just like smashing it. And I walked in, I was like, oh my God, is this Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? Like, what is this what it does for you? And I was like, hello. And he's like, hello. And that's like,
it's a stark contrast to the butt scooters you see in like, some competitions.
I was like, I was really fascinated because everyone was just like rolling and Pete was there, Peter DeBean was there. And I was just like, what is this? what are you guys doing? And he's like, oh, this is Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I was like, yeah, but what is it? Yeah, Gallen, have a roll. Gallen, get on the line. And I was like, yeah, but I don't know what I'm doing. You can't punch and you can't kick. If you get in trouble, you get hurt, just tap on the ground or just say stop or no, you'd be fine. Gallen, get out there. And I was like, okay. I had no gi. Like, it was just shorts and a shirt. But I was like, whatever, I'm game. And
this is all in the first time you walked up the stairs.
This is the first time I ever came in, right? But I was like, that's me. Like, I was just like, whatever, let's have a go, right? So I got on the line. I just got submitted like 60 plus times in, like, it was just like jail rape. Like, I was just getting beaten down by some of the grisliest dudes. They didn't care. There was no beginner lesson. It was just like, snap, snap, snap. And this is the most frustrating experience of my entire life. Like, it shattered me. Because, like, I thought, oh, I'm fit, I'm strong. I can, you know, I'll deal with
situations. You've been physically building yourself for years.
Yeah, yeah, just working away, you know. And I just got killed.
Mm.
And afterwards, I was just so mad. And Pete's like, did you love it? Did you love it? I was like, no, I didn't love it.
Crying on the inside.
Like, I was just like, you didn't teach me anything. Like, and I was like, you're going to teach me something? And he's like, yeah, yeah. Come back, we'll teach you something. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, I was so mad, man. I was like, it hurt me. It hurt my heart, hurt my man pride. Like, I just couldn't handle it, you know. I was stomping around for 2 weeks. I couldn't go back. I was like, man, I hate jiu-jitsu. Fuck jiu-jitsu. Oh. And then, like, after a while, I just had to, like, accept it. And then I just went in there and I just bought a gi. And then it was on and it just didn't stop.
Very, very humbling experience.
Oh, man. Brutal, but awesome. So definitely that experience changed my life.
That's fantastic. Tell us more about your time at DeBeans.
Oh, man, look, you know, Pete's awesome. You know, if it wasn't for Peter DeBean and John Will, there just wouldn't be jiu-jitsu in this country.
That's right.
You know, and it's amazing that those two guys, you know, both from Victoria, made the journey. And I've kind of done my historical study in terms of talking to different people, having met John, trained with John, understanding him, you know, spent a fair bit of time with Pete, doing privates with him. I think that at that time, Peter DeBean Jiu-Jitsu was like the strongest academy just because of there's just so many people training there. There wasn't many other options. Mm. And, yeah, it was great. I mean, it was brutal. I didn't learn a lot of Jiu-Jitsu. I just learned survival.
Mentality.
Right. Yeah, like it was just like I was getting beat down so much and I only really started to learn technique. I only really learned like one sweep, like flower sweep, like arm across, flower sweep, armbar from mount, like or armbar from close guard. That was the only thing I knew for like a year. My whole white belt, I knew like one technique and the rest of it was just like not get destroyed or just tap a lot. So yeah, it was toughness. It was just getting beat down by the higher belts. And look, I did privates with Pete, but I think like what he showed me or what he taught me was kind of a bit beyond my comprehension. So I think that was the hard thing. But no, I mean, it was awesome. I think at that time, there's so many good people there. Because at that time, Ninos, Donos, he was you know, he was a brown belt there. And he was
still coach of Australian elite team.
Yeah, coach of Australian elite, head of Australian elite team, which is like just one of the biggest
team.
And best teams in yep. Australia. I mean, Dan Cherubin was still under Pete at that time. So you had like Ninos, Big Mick, you know, Dan Cherubin. You had a lot of awesome jiu-jitsu going on in the one space.
And all heavyweights.
Yeah, huge guys,
a lot of
man.
Big guys, man.
Big yeah. units. And even all the other guys like Paul Leahy and then like just there's so many good guys out of DeBeans who are black belts now. I mean, Chris Dirksen is one of the toughest humans on the planet and he was a lightweight and he was holding it down with all those guys. There's so many guys there. It was so interesting. Angus Friend taught me a lot. He's actually one of the guys who taught me the most. Mick Doe, he's a really nice guy. He's a pharmacist. He played inverted guard. No one played that.
Yeah.
So it was really cool, you know. And what was cool was it taught me about jiu-jitsu lineage and Gracie Baja and Carlos Gracie and the Gracies. But then ultimately, when I left the Beans, I learned more about the other side of jiu-jitsu and other lineage and other people's training. So. Yeah. But no, it was a great place to start.
Yep. Fantastic. So
So jiu-jitsu is actually taking you all the way back to the motherland of jiu-jitsu, Brazil.
Yeah,
you spent a bit of time there training. Tell us a little bit about it. You did some jiu-jitsu over there. I understand you were training some pretty high-level athletes over at Allianz.
Yeah. Well, the first trip I ever went on was in 2009, and I was just training in Rio, and I was training at Gordo Jiu-Jitsu, and then also I went and did a couple of sessions at Gracie Baja in Baja.
So anyone who's familiar with Half Guard, correct me if I'm wrong, Gordo is one of the founding fathers of the Half Guard.
Yeah, and that was circumvent of an injury. Yep. So he had an injured leg, and so he was playing Half Guard, and he really pushed that. And really what was awesome about Gordo is he was also the MMA coach. So he's a tough guy, and he had a lot of tough guys to deal with. And at that time, Gracie Baja was the hub. Like, everybody was training there. So to be one of the top guys there was just phenomenal. And that was the team of that time. I think over time what I learned was there's a whole other part to Brazil, which is Sao Paulo.
Mm.
And, I mean, obviously there's other states, you know, and many, many other cities. But I guess the capital cities, just like Sydney and Melbourne, you really have like Rio and Sao Paulo. And the climates not too dissimilar. So, yeah, it was like over time I started to see these guys compete who are pretty amazing, who are guys from Allianz team. And I started to hear more about them and observe just how successful they were. And then I was like, wow, I want to go to Sao Paulo. Someone has said, like, yeah, you should go to Sao Paulo and train there. It hadn't occurred to me. And then is actually the thing that changed my mind, or the thing that moved me to do that, was training with Cabrinha. So I had a stopover. It's like my third time to Brazil, 2000. And
so Cabrinha is pretty much a record holder in the lightweight division, I believe. Lightweight, he's approaching 40 and not slowing down whatsoever, winning world championship after championship.
He's nonstop. He's definitely up there with greatest of all time, you know, four-time ADCC champion, four-time world gi champion. You know, like, the guy is pretty insane. And also, you know, capoeira black belt, and just like one of the amazing athlete.
Amazing chef too, apparently.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, he started as a pastry chef. So whenever he gets the opportunity, you can see him, like, sometimes on his Instagram, if he goes to Abu Dhabi, they let him in the kitchen. And, man, the guy can, he can whip up a mean cake. This. Yeah, he can, man. So he told me, I went, like, when he first opened his academy in L.A., I just had a stopover, and I was like, well, damn, I'm in LA for 2 days. I'll go train with Cabrinha. And when I was there, he's like, oh, where are you training in Brazil? I said, oh, I'm going to Rio. He said, man, you got to go to Sao Paulo and train with Allianz, train with Fabio. Like, you can't.
So Fabio Galeb, head coach of Allianz, and Allianz, which we didn't touch on before, one of the biggest, probably the most successful jiu-jitsu team, if not Gracie Baja. One of the biggest, most powerful.
I think they're the most, I guess it's like, they've won the most world titles, like team trophies. So,
and the most dominant at the moment.
Yeah. So it's been pretty close to them the last couple of years, because Team Atos is such a strong team, even though they're small. So many great athletes and competitors out of that team. Fabio Gugel has just been, just an amazing coach and leader. And so, yeah, I had to go visit, and it changed my life. It was just next level to go to the city where people are so focused on their jiu-jitsu. So, yeah, being introduced to the Allianz team changed my mind about jiu-jitsu, changed my mind about pressure, changed my mind about wrist locks and foot locks and everything else, and pressure passing. And so, yeah, that started a relationship that's been ongoing for the last couple of years. Whenever I go to Brazil, I always go to Sao Paulo and train with the guys there. So, I've been really fortunate that at different times, when I first went there, everyone was there. So Bruno Malfacini was still there. Lucas Lepre was there. Bernardo Faria was there.
Like a lightweight champion, middleweight champion. And you said Bernardo Faria?
Yeah, and
heavyweight champion.
Leonardo Nogueira, who was world absolute champion at that time. Yep. He actually beat Bruschetta that year.
Another huge guy.
Yeah, he's a massive unit. And then, you know, Gabby Luana. Everybody was pretty much Tarsus. Everyone was there. So when you stood on the line and he lined up all the black belts in the middle, everybody's a world champion. And he's like, all right, guys.
And not just a world champion, like a current world champion. In that moment in time.
Man, it's so frightening, just being like a purple belt. And they're like, right, go take them down. Like, what? Like, one of my best friends, Fabinho Colloy, who is a top featherweight out of the Allianz team. The first time I met him, he was purple belt. And mind you, he was on his purple belt for about 6 years. But anyway, I watched Gabby Garcia, like, mount him and drop a down elbow. Like, a full, like, face palm down elbow. Because it was, like, a mount escape drill.
Right.
And she's a tough woman. She's always been a tough woman. And Fabinho just put her back in half guard really quick. Like, put her foot back in half guard. And he was like, the drill's over. She was like, no, it's not, you know. And I was next on the line to go in, and she just like was like battling. And Fabinho's like, I don't know, he can be a bit annoying. But he's like, no, the drill's over, you're done. And she just like pushed on his face and just bam, dropped the elbow and split his nose.
What the hell, man?
I was like, oh, ooh. And then Fabinho's like, oh, he didn't even blink. He just got up and he was like, don't worry about it, I'll just go off. He was just streaming blood out of his face.
So has Fabinho like a mate from Australia, or are you Brazilian?
Yeah, he's a Brazilian guy, and he's Fabinho's one of the top guys there. And I went up to him after that, I was like, man, what happened? And he was like, oh, it's just Gabby. She's just like that. And I was like, what? Like, that's normal, you know, that's fine. And then I said, oh man, your English is really good. He's like, yeah, I lived in Australia for a period of time, studied English. He's like, man, if you want to come hang out in Brazil, you should come and live with my family. So I formed a relationship there, and so he really...
Yeah, really hospitable.
Yeah, man, he hooked me up and looked after me for the subsequent times I've been to Brazil, and also looked after Lockie too. So if it wasn't for Fabinho...
Lockie Giles
wouldn't have got hooked up either. So I said to him, when you go to Brazil, man, make sure you stay with my friend Fabinho. And... Yep. For the record, I didn't, like, at that time, I never got to go to their awesome pimping holiday house. Because it's amazing, like, exclusive beach family resort house. You can have, like, 20 people in it. I'd never been there. I only heard about it. And then when I wasn't there, it was Christmas time, right? And I saw these photos of Lockie and Livia at this crazy beach house, at the Colloy Beach House. I was like... Damn, man. I was like messaging him. Where was my invite? He friend jacked me. He like stole my best Brazilian friend. I was like, dang, you're getting all the benefits. I ain't seen the benefits. But then I went back there just 2014. And then we all stayed at the beach house. When Liv and Lockie were there too. And then we went to a tournament after that. So in Santos. So that was cool.
Very nice.
Amazing. So... what are some of the, I'd say, principal differences you've noticed between, say, the training, the lifestyle of jiu-jitsu over in Brazil versus Australia? You know, some of the things like intensity, you know, I guess the volume of training, frequency, really how they go about it, recovery, all of that.
Yeah, look, I think it's like it's funny. I guess it's like what you don't know won't hurt you in the short term. So these guys don't have really any concept about scientific training. What you'll notice is most Brazilians will do a lot better once they get to America.
Yep.
Because they're getting access to physios who are really good. They're getting access to proper strength conditioning coaches, and they're also in environments that foster recovery. I think the nature of Brazilian jiu-jitsu in Brazil is similar to like Taekwondo in Korea. The way they would do it is they would just set the most demanding, hard-out training ever, and whoever didn't break or whoever broke the least kind of rose to the top. And all right, you're the toughest, you'll be champ.
Just weeding out the weak, really, but it's looking to develop the most resilient, not necessarily...
Well, yeah, not necessarily the best.
Exactly.
Like, it's just you're the toughest. And on value of toughness, you're the best. And that's why there's all these guys in Brazil who are amazing, who you never hear about, whether they couldn't come to Brazil for visa reasons... So they couldn't come to America from Brazil because of visa reasons, or they had a crim record or whatever the story. They're still there churning away super hard with all of the champions, making the champions champions, but you never hear about them. So I think the intensity is much higher because they roll to the death, like absolutely. I thought it was like actually, like I thought they were picking on me. It's like, man, these guys are just beating me down. It's a gringo thing. Why are they bashing me? But actually, when I got to sit back and look, when they rolled each other, even the guys who are very close friends, they're so brutal. So brutal. If you got your wrist taped, they'll wrist lock your your taped wrist. You know, if you've got your foot taped, like tape both feet so I don't know which one's bad.
Right.
Like guys are trying to just come at you 100%. So you've got to be prepared for that level of intensity. Also, they're training 2 or 3 times a day. Now, I think once people, certain champions hit a certain level, once they've banked 10,000, 20,000 hours, they definitely taper back from a skill point of view, but the intensity is always super high. And yeah, and that's what I'm saying, like they don't know about recovery. Mm. So they're like, well, I'll have some acai. That's awesome. I hear that's good for cutting weight.
Delicious, 90% high volumes of sugar.
Sugar. So, you know, sorbet as a recovery food is questionable. But I think ultimately, having been there and seen it, you do get used to it. And I think if you get used to it at a younger age, that's cool. But I think the misconception is that these guys who are really good at Brazilian jiu-jitsu are like favela kids. They got nothing to do. They're just doing jiu-jitsu. That is 5% of anyone you'll ever see. The guys you see are elite. Their families are either very wealthy or the club has sponsored them. Brazilian jiu-jitsu is an expensive sport. Essentially, I guess a guy...
Particularly when your competitors have to pay their own way and there's, you know, there's a very high barrier of entry to start making money.
The guys you're fighting are thoroughbreds, right? They've chosen to do this as opposed to do their economics degree.
Yeah.
They're doing this because their parents can pay $3,500 a year for their...
They've got that safety net.
...fees, yeah. Judo is sponsored by the government. So that's an Olympic sport, right? But jiu-jitsu is not. You need to have a lot of money to train jiu-jitsu. You're either like absolutely the best and you're sponsored, or what's awesome, or the exception for like Meows and Leandro is a Projet Social where they can train for free and they've been able to elevate themselves. But honestly, the guys you're fighting, they got the best supplements, they got maids who make their food, and all they do is train. And that's what they live for. I think that's the difference. In Australia, we have awesome lives, and we have a lot of options. So we lose a tournament, we go, aw, better go have a smoothie. Better go have a really nice dinner with all my team.
Better have that chicken parmesan I deny myself for 2 weeks.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not so do or die. And I think, like, what's really interesting is going to Brazil and seeing all that. You're seeing super, super tough poor people fighting to the death. And then you're seeing the super rich, super elite, like, I will conquer the world because I'm better than all of you. And that's a different mentality, you know?
So just honing in on, I guess, that training intensity that you've touched on, it almost sounds like you've got a significant... portion of competitors and athletes who are being filtered out because of the arduous training. It's that intense that, you know, the risk of injury, the likelihood of injury is drastically increased, such that there's a significant amount of high-level competitors that eventually their careers end early.
Yeah, no, that's entirely true. That's entirely true. And a lot of people...
Like people we'd never have heard of.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's even a fluke that we've heard of some of the competitors we've heard of, like Sergio Moraes. Like you never would have heard of him. Part of the reason why he wasn't out in competitions earlier was just the Allianz team sponsored him to come up. He was doing so well in Brazil, but he just never, ever had that money. Yeah. And there's so many people like that. But the injury thing is phenomenal. But that's the thing. These guys, it's like if it's injured, tape it. There's just, you just train. There's no excuse. Whereas what we're taught... And it makes sense, right? Like, you don't have permanent ligament damage.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you don't want to have long-term arthritis in your joints. But, like, Cabrinha doesn't have any ACLs. Like, so part of the reason why Michael Lange and I are close, he tore, well, Tarsus tore his... Peace out, Tarsus.
Tarsus, Humphreys.
Yeah, I love you, Tarsus. Don't take this as a diss. You're an animal. I love you. but Tarsus knee-barred Michael really hard and tore his ACL. So Lockie was there.
Cabrinha or Lange's?
Lange's
ACL. Yep.
So the advice to Lange is 8 weeks out from Worlds 2014, don't fight Worlds. Take the surgery, do whatever. And he was like shattered. Like he was lining up to be champ that year. It was going to be a big year for him. And he said to me, what would you do? And I said, man, how's your knee feel? He says, my knee feels okay. And I'm like, well, we can strap your knee hard out. And you can probably do this. Like, the guy's got massive quads. Like, he's got the musculature to hold the knee together.
So just to make this sense, and I guess accessible to everyone, by having it, how bad was his ACL injured, and what does that
entail? He completely torn his ACL.
What does that entail? How does that affect him as a competitor and actually performing on a mat in a jiu-jitsu sense?
Well, knee stability is severely compromised. So essentially, turning internal external rotation under load is going to be really difficult. Yeah, it's going to be really hard. And what that means is he's just at that much greater risk of tearing the rest of his ligaments in his knee.
Right.
It could be a complete knee reconstruction as opposed to having ACL surgery.
He still has some degree of mobility. He can still
techniques. No, I mean, in the initial, there was a bit of inflammation. But, I mean, once that has settled down, and this is where, like, Mac might be able to come through and provide a bit more insight. But in terms of what I understand about, like, ACL injuries, the knee capsule is intact, medial and collateral ligaments are intact, PCL is intact. He had control over the knee joint, but under like a lot of force or extreme torque, which happens all the time in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, that's what jiu-jitsu is about.
Yeah, especially if you're playing Spider Guard and people are just throwing your legs around, the chance of you hurting your knee is really high. So this is what Fabio Gugel said to Michael. Oh, Michael, Cobrinha doesn't have ACLs. He's 4 times champion. You can win the championship. And he was like, man, because Cobrinha's his master. Like, Cobrinha gave him his black belt, right? So he had all this guilt and weight on him. He still came through and won bronze that year. You know, I taped his knee every day. We did his rehab. He did crazy training to get his knee up to a position where he felt confident to do it. He still got out there, and he lost very contentiously against JT Torres on a decision.
Mm.
And then Lucas Lepre bashed JT Torres in the final. But, I mean, that's the thing. Who's his teammate?
His teammate.
Who's also considered to be one of Alliance's best, you know, lightweight fighters.
Of all time.
Yeah, one of the best of all time. So it's just really interesting to see that over there, it's like you've got no ACL, tape your knee, and fight anyway. This is the mentality. And I guess if you've got a club full of champions, you can just throw people hard at it. I think the difficulty for us here in Australia is, you know, we have a limit.
We have the luxury.
Well, we have the luxury to choose, but we also have a limit on how many brown belts we've got going into Worlds.
Yep.
We've got a limit on how many black belts are going in at Worlds. We don't want to sacrifice anybody. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying that Michael's being compromised. At the end of the day, it was his choice as an athlete. He made that choice. He competed well. And after his knee surgery, his knee was fine. He didn't incur any further injury. But what I'm saying is, because we have choice, and being the first well-educated people
like
we are,
we have a plethora of options when it comes to our lifestyle and where we go with it.
We just say, nah, I'm not going to risk it. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a huge difference in mentality between the cultures, definitely. So what else stands out to you about the difference culturally and otherwise between jiu-jitsu there and here?
Look, I think S&C in Australia is awesome. I think our level of understanding of anatomy, physiology, advanced training methodologies, and I mean, even yourself, Mac, you know, you've put so much time and energy into your education the last, you know, 8 years, 10 years, you know, we have access to it and it's expected. This is the standard now, you know, and whereas there, people still doing CrossFit. And that's no slight on CrossFit. What I'm saying is, if you want to be good at jiu-jitsu, you don't train CrossFit. CrossFit's its own sport. Like, it's like triathlon. Like, you don't go
exercise champions.
Like, I want to get really good at running. I'm going to up my CrossFit. Well, look, it's a very specific thing. Like, if you are trying to do CrossFit, that's your sport, and you want to get good at that framework, then that's what you need to do. You don't take up swimming to get good at CrossFit. Vice versa. You don't take up CrossFit to get good at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And the guys were doing kipping chins, and they were wrecking their hands, you know, getting real crazy palm tears.
Oh, man, that's disgusting.
And then they couldn't grip. Like, you know, no grip, no fight, right?
Absolutely.
So, so also bacteria, right? You don't want to get... I mean, it's hard
open
enough...
Open
wounds on the mat, like, you don't get skin infections. So when I was there, I was seeing these guys like doing CrossFit because, like, CrossFit's hard, that must be good because hard is good. And I was like, no, actually, we need to not do this. So that's where I think the difference is culturally in Brazil. They're still on the bodybuilder, still on the aerobicize fitness. Like, I actually got banned from doing deadlifts in a gym. Like, man, this is terrible, right? As in Be Fit Academy, right? Man, forget those guys. They even
did
had
you
a
drop,
video.
Dropping, dropping the weights?
No, Be- and this is probably because I wasn't wearing like a Lycra onesie and had a mad booty. My booty's not bad, but it wasn't like,
pretty right.
It wasn't Brazil level. Because there were a lot of women doing sumos, you know, because, you know, that's getting the glutes on, right? And there are plenty of women doing a lot of like kind of leg kickbacks, get that emphasis, whatever. No hip thrust, by the way, no barbell hip thrust. Clearly not on that Brett Contreras life. But anyway, it was funny because I had a video playing, right? Because the trainers weren't really training people.
Yeah.
It's just like, it was like a 24, it wasn't 24/7 gym, but they had videos on how to train.
Mm.
And they were doing deadlifts in the video. So I'm doing deadlifts, but I just happened to be using a lot of the weight. So they were like, no, you can't do that here. It's unsafe. And I was like, she's doing it. She just looks better than me and is lifting less. That's not fair. So, but that's what I'm saying. It's a culture thing. It's like there's so much about aesthetics and that is very, very popular for both men and women. So functional strength training, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, it's not in the culture.
Just not on the menu.
No, not at all. So when you come in and you say to people, you have a shoulder injury, you shouldn't do shoulder press. That's like an alien concept. People are like, but shoulder press make shoulders strong.
Yeah.
No, stop. So that was a big cultural fight for me to try and get the guys to even talk about recovery.
Right.
And that's where we're leaping bounds ahead.
You're talking the dark ages to the information age, really.
Yeah, pretty much. And the funny thing about it is they're still producing amazing athletes.
Yeah.
And it's just based off sheer will,
just grit,
and volume of training.
Yeah.
And I just want it more than you, and I'll kill you for it.
Right.
And I mean, that's a great quality, but they are definitely about intensity. They're not about longevity.
Yep.
And it makes you wonder where some of those athletes would be now if they had more of that.
Yeah. It's almost like they're seeing all this success in the sport in spite of the methods they've been using.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And that's also because they got, I don't know, like 260 million people. And people are very passionate, you know, whether they're doing capoeira, they're doing football, or they're doing jiu-jitsu, boxing. Like, Brazilians are passionate people and they live it 100%. And I think that it made me more passionate too. Well, I'm a passionate guy. Don't get me wrong.
You're a very passionate guy.
But when you see those guys, man, when you see the 9-year-old kids just beating their chest and like...
hand to heart. And
flying armbar and tearing the gi off, and you're like, okay, I understand how you... when you're 18 years old, you're tearing shreds off everybody, you know.
It kind of all comes into perspective when you see shit like that,
when
right?
you see the young kids, man, and you think... And also, they oftentimes, when it's in a basketball stadium, they have it caged off. So you can't get in. Like, only athletes can get in. They got these, like kind of fat, not very mobile security. They only let, like, players in. But, it's to stop people jumping out on the mat. Like, it's... people would... they're so passionate, you know, and they're not afraid to punch on either. So, you know, like, I think if there's anything I really took away from Brazil, it was, like, the love of the art, like, the pure dedication of just no excuses, always train, and community.
Mm.
Like, when you don't train, you still go to the gym to hang with everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we do that here, but everyone eats together, lives together. You always socialize with the club because, like, comunidade, that's, like, the strong thing, and that's why the team ethic is so strong in Brazil, and that definitely comes from just the nature of the society. Mm. Yeah.
So as a strength and conditioning coach, with your experiences training some of these very elite competitors, we're talking world champions, how do you approach their training? So you look at what they're doing, what they're currently doing with their training, you know, you analyze those opportunities. How do you actually approach the training as a coach?
I think first of all, having a look at the guys, because they've already got such a high skill level, a lot of what you've got to do is contrast training. A lot of what you're doing is correcting the evils that are done on the mat. I would say rule number one for any competitor from, you know, amateur through to pro, like the rule, like the, I should say goal number one is no injuries. injury prevention is key.
Mm.
The overuse is crazy.
Yeah, it's like the you need the Hippocratic Oath, really.
Yeah,
going
yeah.
First, do no harm.
No harm, 100%. I'm with you. And then you're going, right, well, you already spend 6 hours a day gripping. To improve your grip, do we need to do any grip training? Probably not.
Mm.
In all truth, you probably need a really good forearm treatment. So in truth, like, you need to go, right, how can I teach you to be, you teach you some self-maintenance? And then also, how can I get you stronger where you're weak right now? Or how can we just keep you from making things worse? Because guys will always train. It's just a mentality. Broken rib, train. Broken wrist, train. So you have to content, like, come on, like, you're a jiu-jitsu guy, right, Brendan? Like, you know, how many times have you gone, oh, I'll just drill.
Yeah.
You know, like, you still get there, right? You still, because that's...
We'll lightly roll until, like, you start beating me, then I'll increase
intensity.
And then
we're going to dial up, and then, yeah. So I think, you know, you've sustained your own level of injuries almost to the point of no return.
Oh, absolutely, a few times.
Yeah, and that's frightening, especially when you kind of take,
especially when it becomes a pillar of your life and it becomes like an epicenter really to everything you do and everything you're about, and have that stripped away, is it's a terrifying thought.
Yeah. And but these guys, that's a thing for them. They have, the guys who are the best at jiu-jitsu don't have anything else. They're fully dedicated to that, and that's pretty much, that's all they do. And I think the thing I was looking at with these guys was trying to get them to do things that they weren't accustomed to. So getting on a foam roller. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Revolution, people. Mm-hmm. And then just doing basic mobility work. Because, I mean, people are like, yoga is very popular. People are pretty au fait with just doing some static stretching, but, like, no real PNF work, no kind of band-resisted, band-assisted work. And I think...
So what are the benefits of bands, just as sort of a general knowledge piece to take away?
Well, I think, look, dynamic tension, when used for strengthening, is beneficial. Different people have different standpoints on that. I know, you know, like, I've kind of done my own research into it in terms of not, but like my own study into it in terms of looking at what the best people in strength conditioning are doing, having a look at, I guess the studies are limited, and a lot of people have their anecdotal work. It's hard to get peer-reviewed stuff because even though people might be sports scientists, they're too busy running their S&C facility to be in the lab.
Mm.
Right? But, you know, whether it be someone like Charles Poliquin or Louis Simmons, even though there may be contentions about certain techniques, doing a dynamic day, whether that be related to bar speed or dynamic tension like chains or bands or like deload bars, like, it's been shown that this can improve recruitment. And depending on who you talk to and what they say, that improving that rate of recruitment long-term will get you better strength or greater strength gains in a shorter period of time.
Right.
Now, how that plays out long-term, I'm not sure. But if you give somebody a band-resisted chin and they've never done that before, and you factor that into something that's properly periodized, and that's not something, periodization is not, that's only... The only people get access to that kind of training are top-level footballers in Brazil.
Right.
There's no such thing as periodization in Brazil. Like, there's always a jiu-jitsu comp.
Mm.
So it's like, train, and there's a comp on Saturday.
Training, yeah. Train and compete on the weekend.
So we'll just train no gi on Friday.
Yeah.
Like, there's, you know, and if we're training for Worlds, let's just train really hard 3 weeks before Worlds and have a day off.
Mm.
Yeah. That's
and we'll call, jiu-jitsu. And we'll call it a training camp.
Yeah, that's jiu-jitsu periodization,
thinking,
right?
Right?
Yeah. So that's crazy to me because I've seen that firsthand, and it's brutality because the guys are going so hard before comp because also it's this environment of, like, who's got it this year? And you're flexing on your own team.
Mm.
And you could hurt your own team. And I've seen people like 5 days out from comp, Bruno Malfacini get bloody almost tear his, you know, LCL on a takedown drill. Like, what is going on? You know, like, that blows my mind to see that because that's just what they've learned and they, you know, that's what guys are working with. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think in the last, even just in the time I've done jiu-jitsu, it's changed. Guys are getting a lot better. There's a lot more outside input and there's a lot more Brazilians living in America training with better people, doing that thing. But I think what I was able to at least show some of the guys was some very basic mobility and recovery stuff, which we just take as normal. We do with our clients every day. Bloody your weekend warrior is doing here, you know.
Yeah. Every Cert 3 and 4 fitness course.
Yeah, you know, we just take it for granted, but it doesn't exist there. So when you introduce it, people are like, dang, you're a guru, you're so smart. And I'm like, no, I'm not, but I'm glad it helps. So yeah, I think that's where I was able to help. And also just spending some time with the guys going, just rest today. They're like, oh, wow. And then, oh, I feel better. Like the next day, oh, I feel better. Yeah, that's...
Because you're rested. This is what rested feels like.
That's and that's a crazy thing. We don't fully get that because we don't push as hard as that necessarily within jiu-jitsu. I shouldn't generalize, but yeah.
Yeah, well, there's different pressures, obviously societal pressure over there. It's the way it is. Their culture is so much pressure to work that hard. So to take a day off is crazy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would
definitely.
You do that?
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I can't remember who said it to me, but it said, what if I told you? Okay, you know, it's like a meme, you know? It's like Morpheus.
Drawing on the
meme.
Matrix.
Oh, that's right.
You
the
know,
Matrix.
Like, what if I told you that by having a rest day, you would get stronger?
Yeah.
Oh my God, mind blown. So,
yeah. So back to something you started off that with. You were talking about contrast training.
Mm.
Could you just shed a bit more light on that for everyone?
Definitely. Well, I think if you have a look at any, if you're looking at any athlete in any sport, if they are habitually doing an activity, the chances of them, especially if they're at a professional level, they are likely to have overuse issues because they're just pushing. They're pushing the very limit of what they can do. What is probably not addressed is the kind of weak point training or strengthening those muscles that they're like, and I think it was...
stabilizing muscles.
Yeah, definitely.
Movements.
When you've got people who have very forward posture, you know, they're almost kyphotic, hip flexors are super jacked, you know,
Sounds like every jiu-jitsu guy.
Yeah, because it's like the nature, it doesn't matter what you do. I mean, I think, to be honest, like even looking at like a corporate athlete, having spent so much time in the Rialto and seeing these
Fit
guys.
Line represent, man.
You know, I spent 7 years in that environment. They were getting overuse injuries from not doing things.
Yeah.
So they're sitting at a desk. Their hips are super jacked. Their hip flexors are so
very
tight.
Unnatural positions.
Their glutes not active, and their posture is so forward. But it took them 10 years to get like that. Whereas jiu-jitsu person, they've got it from like overuse. Maybe they got like that in 3 or 4 years. Mm. But the funny thing is, similar problems present.
Mm.
The difference is, the office warrior or the corporate athlete is going to go, social game of footy, and I tore my hamstring.
Yep.
Whereas the jiu-jitsu person is going to be like, tournament, tear my hamstring, keep going, tournament. And that's the thing. The more jiu-jitsu people I encounter from the amateur level through the pro level, people are not getting the proper help. You know, and I think that's where someone like yourself, Mac, and even working with Teresa at Optimum Muscular Health.
Shameless plug.
Obviously, working with, you know, some of the top people in jiu-jitsu, you know, that's where you guys are probably affecting the different, like the amount of times I went to Teresa and went, I think I've torn this ligament, that ligament, I got this problem, that problem, having all these weird injuries that occur through jiu-jitsu because you just don't get them doing any other sport. You teach people how to look after themselves. Whereas, obviously, if all you've done in your life is jiu-jitsu and you have no idea about anatomy and physiology and your student comes in and goes, I've got a sore shoulder, you have no means to try and help them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of they've got the harden up mentality because, you know, that information's not apparent. But what's great about what the change now is that jiu-jitsu athletes are being treated in that way. People are getting more help, getting more information, getting more knowledge, and better looking after their bodies. And what I try and do is go, guys, I know you thought you're going to come in here and maybe rip massive deadlifts, but actually, touch your toes.
Surely that has to do a lot with jiu-jitsu invariably being a sport that's very new and emerging, and so a lot of health professionals can't relate, or, you know, jiu-jitsu doesn't resonate with them as clearly as, say, football, for example, where it's very well understood, the mechanics of, say, soccer or football and running kind of movements and jumping and all the different actions and movements are involved. But you talk about jiu-jitsu, you literally have to sit down with the doctor and explain, okay, so let me try and explain to you that he grabbed my head and he sat on me and squeezed it really hard and I tapped, and they look at you like, and you chose to do this. And it's like, yeah, it's a lot of fun, but you have to really break down these movements and explain to them how you arrived at this point of pain, so they can at least understand mechanically what went wrong or how you've possibly hurt yourself.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And look, Andrew Locke, great physio, great power lifter, great guy, Dr. Locke. Look, he said to me, look, if someone wants to bend your arm the wrong way, in that moment, if they're stronger than you and your arm's isolated, your arm's going to bend the wrong way, you know. Mm. But obviously, if the muscles and tendons and ligaments are strong, they are less likely to break, less likely to snap.
Or less damage.
Less damage, yeah. So that's great. So the joint has more support. But he's like, man, like if someone's twisting you off the wrong way, it can happen. That's what you're doing. That's just tap. That's your sport, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So just on that, it's quite mentioned. Both yourself, Mac, and JT have mentioned that one of the benefits that weightlifting confers to jiu-jitsu, for example, is injury prevention. Mm-hmm. So you talk about injury prevention and lifting to prevent injuries. So how does that operate? How does that work?
Well, like I was saying before about, say, contrast training, like if you've got guys who have insanely tight hip flexors and they're getting impingement at the hip, or they're getting referral, or any of these things, like, or they're getting a lot of trouble in the lower back, spending a fair bit of time trying to just get the hip more balanced. I'm not saying we've got to tighten the glutes up like they have to have the biggest, strongest glutes, but you want to spend some time opening those hips up and getting the glutes engaged just for the sake of stabilizing the pelvis. You know, like just doing that. And that doesn't sound that strange if you're a S&C, but a jiu-jitsu person goes, well, I need strong glutes for? Like, I just need to be able to put my foot behind my head, right?
Yeah.
Like, because I want to just be a meow.
I want to triangle upside down.
Yeah, yeah. I want to be able to triangle myself.
Yeah.
You know? And that, yeah, I mean, yeah, oh, sure, that's okay. But, like, I think that is definitely the big difference, is that people look at strength training almost like it's a luxury. Like, yeah. Oh, I don't need to do that. But if I said to you, you know,
What if I told you?
We could reduce your injuries like down to like a third. Like, because it's, how frustrating is it?
Yeah.
You get injured, you can't be on the mat. So when you love a thing and you can't do it, and it's not even that you, it's like mentally you can't work it out. You know what is wrong.
Mm.
And you know what you need to do, but you just want to do that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the most frustrating experience, especially if the injury doesn't even feel that significant, but doing more of it is going to make it worse.
Yeah.
So it's that delayed, it's such a frustrating thing, a delayed satisfaction. And I think injury time, like time off the mat, is which holds back so many jiu-jitsu people across the world. So
when you say time off the mat, I mean, obviously when you're injured, you're taken away from the sport and you're limited in the amount of time you can train, that's going to hurt you. Are you referring to knowing when to take some time off in order to rehabilitate and recover?
Well, I think you don't have a choice. I think if you're on the mat and you're injured, then you're living in fantasy land.
Yeah.
Yeah? Because ultimately you want to do the thing you love as much as you can for as long as you can.
Mm.
You know, a really good analogy I heard about is something different. It's actually coming from an artist. Said, we're all in this race, right? And you just want to be at the front for as long as you can.
Mm.
And then when you can't run the race anymore, the race will continue without you.
Yep.
But you just want to say, when you're in it,
yep,
you just gave it everything and hopefully you're up near the front.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing worse than having to sit on the sideline and watch the race.
Mm. And just be a mere spectator.
Yeah. You want to be in it and amongst it in whatever capacity you choose to participate in it. And that's true with jiu-jitsu. It doesn't matter if you want to be a world champion or not. It doesn't matter if you just want to get in there three days a week.
Mix.
Yeah, being in the mix and just having fun and expressing your body. If you're injured, how much fun are you having? Pain isn't just a neural inhibitor, it's a life inhibitor. You know what I mean? Like,
I hope this isn't a segue, but Marcelo Garcia, funny enough, another Allianz guy, another guy from Brazil, said something amazing about when he talked about coming through the ranks of jiu-jitsu and competing, that Why he didn't get nervous for competitions as much was he used to be excited about competing because it was just a mere opportunity to show everybody what he can do. It's such a funny way of looking at it. I just want to show everyone what I can do in terms of my skill, where it's not necessarily my jiu-jitsu being a representation of my character or my integrity or anything like that. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. And I think, look, Marcelo's a guy who's never promoted strength conditioning training, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people go, oh, well, Marcelo's the GOAT. He doesn't promote strength conditioning.
Yeah.
All right. If people... See, I know a lot of Marcelo's teammates. And I know how many people he beat up. And I know all the guys he beat down on when they were blue belts and he was brown belt. Mm. And they were all copping beatings from him. They will tell you his intensity is insane.
Mm.
That guy has been doing 1RM guillotine lifts for years.
Yeah.
The muscular tension, the nervous tension in that guy is insane. When he does an arm drag, it's 100%. When he goes for the choke, it's 100% squeeze. Like, just because he's not lifting weights.
Such a soft, sweet face. Yeah, there's so much tenacity about him.
It's all lies. All intensity, man. And people will always talk about Marcelo's focus. And that's the thing. When Marcelo rolls, he rolls 100%. Now, he may not be like that now because he's more on that retirement tip. But when you look at those matches and he's gone for those submissions, his face is mean. And he's going 100%. So I would actually say Marcelo has been doing very concentrated, specific strength training his whole career. He just didn't know that.
A very interesting weight-resistant human.
Anyway.
Indeed. So, mate, unless you've got any more about that line of questioning, I would like to change directions, something I do very well.
Okay, let's do that.
What about your own competitive career, for want of a better word? Where are you at with competition these days? You got anything on the horizon?
Look, mate, I think I competed a lot up until I got my brown belt, and I haven't competed that much in the last 2 years. But I will compete every now and again. I think the focus for me had shifted from jiu-jitsu to MMA. Mm-hmm. So spending a lot more time boxing and wrestling. And look, I think ultimately when I look at the landscape of what martial arts is, I love boxing because it's its own art, and that's another 15 years worth of work to try and get any good at that. The difficulty is I am required to use my brain more and more all the time now, and I'm not that good at boxing. And the bad thing about boxing is when you're not so good at boxing, you don't get smarter. So that's the challenge, you know. Like, and I'm really fortunate to have, you know, Pradeep Sehag at Absolute MMA as my boxing coach. And unfortunately, with a man of his experience, I can see the disappointment in his face when I do not learn what he's teaching me so quickly. You know, I don't adapt it so quickly. But I think, look, I feel honestly... The challenge in me is I always wanted to be the best at something since I was a little kid. MMA is a massive monster. The need in me or the want in me to want to fight with somebody in a cage, look, I don't think that'll ever go away. I don't know if it's because I got too much testosterone or just addicted to adrenaline or, you know, like getting in the cage and fighting is like the ultimate rush. But just because something's a rush doesn't mean you should do it.
Mm.
I mean, don't get me wrong, Donald Cerrone, he might argue against that.
Well, Hunter S. Thompson might argue against it.
Yeah, but I mean, that guy's nearly killed himself that many times, you know. Like, and I mean, credit to him. He is a tough, ballsy human. Mm. But I think what I've realized more and more recently, as much as it's hard to swallow, the limitations I have as an athlete are not the limitations I have as a person.
Mm.
So even though I can push my body to absolute breaking because of my will, what is my will going to do when my body's broken?
Mm.
What can I do with myself when I can't function? What good am I to anyone else when I can't walk, etc.? So I think a big realization for me in the last year has been contribution. So... I think what has made me happy recently is I've been training less, but when I've been coming into training, I've been a bit more playful and I've still been hanging. You know, I've still been doing well against the best guys in Australia who are training twice a day every day. And I'm putting it on them. And why is that? I'm fitter and stronger. I'm not training more jiu-jitsu. Mm. And actually, I'm caring less, which is crazy. It used to be all I used to think about. And because I'm coming in caring a bit less, I'm getting tapped plenty, but I'm going for things more. I don't care about the outcome. I'm just going balls out. And that's actually getting me better results.
But care less, enjoy more. Right?
Yeah, but the problem with that is that makes me go, dang.
What if?
I can still hang. You know?
What if I increase intensity still maintain this?
Yeah, and if I just, you know, like, it's
hard to rein yourself in.
Man, it is. And look, I think I used to really care about being a black belt before. And that's not to say that being a black belt is a lifetime achievement. But caring about it doesn't make it happen quicker.
Yeah.
Just like the person who cares the most doesn't necessarily win the championship. Do you know what I mean? Like, for example, my man Ben Hodgkinson... a long-time opponent of mine.
The greatest guy that's never won a world championship.
he's up there. I mean, he cares about the outcome, but he also just doesn't give it stuff in general. Do you know what I mean? And I've seen that guy win almost not trying, and it kind of hurts me because I care so much. I'm like, dude, how come you don't care? Like, in between matches, he's like on Tinder. Like, I'm like, dude, you're at a championship. What are you doing? But it doesn't matter. Being passionate isn't necessary. It can win medals. If you can channel it and you can use it in the right way. But
it's a lot of emotional energy though as well. Yeah,
for sure. And I think that efficiency is key to success. And I've been very inefficient in my life. And just being the caffeinated, all-out person I am, that hasn't always helped me, you know? And I think what I'm doing now is when I'm looking at the people around me and seeing what they're doing, when we talk about delayed satisfaction, I've always wanted to win championships. But now when I look at championships, I think about, like, the last championship I didn't go to, I helped 6 people on that day get that little bit better. And am I being a more effective human being in the sphere of the world by helping more people? Yeah, that's right. As opposed to spending all day in a netball stadium or a basketball stadium hanging out with the same people trying to be king of the hill today. Because we all know each other. Like, it's one of those things. We all know each other. We all train together. We're all friends or frenemies or however we do it. Smile at each other's face and then slag that guy out behind his back. No, I'm not like that. I generally just slag people out to their face. No. But the deal is this, is that in all truth, I have an overwhelming sense of my own mortality. So if I'm not here in 3 years... play the podcast at my funeral. No, that would be terrible. Don't play this podcast at my funeral. But like, if there's anything, like Bruce Lee died when he was 32. And his ultimate aim, ultimately, was to give the world a Chinese superhero. He did that. Mm. You know, he really changed perception of culture.
And he changed the face of martial arts.
He bridged that gap, yeah? And he only made like 7 movies, 8 movies, not including his childhood movies, you know? And man, he did that in that short time he was alive, right? And, you know, and that's, I'm not trying to put myself in that conversation. What I'm saying is that if there's anything I can do in the next 3 years, it's share what I've learned from what I'm doing. And that's try to help other people get better at what they're doing. The guys like Lachlan Giles, Craig Jones, you know, these guys, they're competing flat out, and that's all they do, and that's awesome. And man, I'm so in awe by like how hard they work. But I still put a beating on them. They beat me up, I beat them up. Mm-hmm. Who's fresher on the day? Do you know what I mean? But it doesn't mean I'm winning the championship. They're out there putting it on the line, winning the championship.
Yeah, they're making the sacrifices. They're doing everything to lead up to it.
To make that happen. Yeah. But also, honestly, in all truth, if I can help build champions, that will make me just as happy than if I were to be champion.
Yeah, I think the key word you pointed out earlier was contribution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I reckon that's really noble, man. I've got a lot of respect for that.
No, I think, like, it's just honesty. Like, I'm just life short. So if I'm super selfish on it, could I maybe try and get up in some championships? Yeah. But honestly, that's not going to move the culture forward. That's not going to move everyone forward. Mm. Everyone's not going to get stronger. Like, I got a really good quote from a book called Legacy, which is the 15 lessons we can take from the All Blacks. and when they went from being in the mid-90s kind of choke, they were considered to be chokers on, you know, losing in the final, you know, to being
games.
To being the greatest team of all time.
Yep.
Basically the standard for championship. And one of their maxims or one of their norms right at the end of the book is, are you being a good ancestor?
Hmm.
In 30 years, when someone looks at what you did, would they want to aspire to be like you? Like, are you doing what you're doing? Are you being a world champion S&C? Are you being a world champion community leader? Are you being a world champion person? Did you put your interests before others? Or, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. how many gold medals are going to put on your grave? You know, this isn't a legacy thing. This is a contribution thing because it is greater than all of us.
Yeah.
And it's like, am I being a good ancestor? Would people go, yeah, that person did the good thing at that time? You know, and I definitely, you know, I ascribe to many kind of stoic philosophy. Like, I consider myself to be a modern day stoic, and I read so much philosophy. And stoicism at its heart is all about how to be a good person. Like, what would a good person do? And that doesn't mean you have to be friends with everyone. It doesn't mean you have to be, like, popular. None of that. It's like, how do I move towards being the better person?
Yep.
And in truth, the better person in me is not winning 4 gold medals. That's honestly what it is.
Yep.
And as much as there's some vain egotism in, just the ego in me compels me to want to compete all the time, you know, I got to create something, I got to leave something, and that's not a championship gold medal.
Yep.
So you'll see me at comps. You'll see me getting into it just for the fun of it. But that will be, it's very different. It means something very different to me now.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like as you sort of expressed, you've been really getting into the philosophical mindsets, picking up with stoicism and different sort of ways, I guess, of looking at embracing the lessons we can learn from life. So just out of curiosity, is there a concept or a philosophy or an idea that you've once firmly held but have since superseded or moved on from or even just discarded? It's something you might have held on to and was a really strong belief and at some point in time, you've had to really, you know, have a dialogue and a conversation with your inner monologue and really let go of something in order to grow and move forward.
I think there's a lot of things I let go of. And I think a lot of it was to do with I think it's probably more just being individualistic, like I'm an individual, therefore that counts me as separate. No. Yeah, everybody's unique, everybody's different, but we're all within our context and we're all human beings. So I feel that I am different to everybody, but I'm still a human being. I still tore the ligament in my knee. I still fear rejection. I'm still scared of death. Still everything else. It doesn't matter how much energy I have or how much will I have. At the end of the day, that's the rules apply. You know, 100 years, who knows? You know, what's it matter? You know, like Marcus Aurelius said, it's jokes on him, by the way, because we're still talking about him. But like 3,500 years ago, he's like, oh, this won't matter because no one will ever read it. Blah, blah, blah.
In meditation. It's
like, oh, no, dude. Actually, it's a Penguin classic. So, psych, Marcus Aurelius, you were wrong. A tattoo one of my best friends has, she's Brazilian, is the line from Gladiator, which is like, what we do now
echoes eternity.
In eternity.
Yeah.
But it's real. But is it what do you do now?
Yes.
That echoes in eternity. Yes. And this is perpetuated throughout culture,
yep,
in a lot of ways, in cliche Hollywood ways and all kinds of stuff. But the truth is, like, if someone just asks you, like, you know, what could you do without? You know, and I used to say, like, I would never give up anything for jiu-jitsu. But, like, I think if there's one thing I've done well in my life, it's just help other people through being a personal, yep, trainer. And it's not till you hear back from your clients what you do and what that means to them, you go, wow, it actually means a lot. Even though it sounds superficial and there's all these stereotypes about the industry and everything like that, from at least my own perspective, being able to help a lot of people, which has been awesome. But I would like to go bigger and broader than that. And look, I feel the thing that hurts me is looking at people who are very successful in a monetary way or the way they're put up in the media, like Floyd Mayweather or Conor McGregor. These guys have nothing to say. What are they teaching you about life other than live life to excess? You should get a Maybach, otherwise you're a loser.
Mm.
Like, these guys are like bad gangster rappers, but they can't rap.
Yeah.
Like, playing to a cliche. Yeah, it's awesome. How many cliches do we see in life? It just hurts your mind because it shows you how weak humans are because they don't want to form their own mold. They're just playing to another. And that just, that's why I just can't stand that. And that's part of the reason why I got, like, as much as I was so excited by MMA, I was also just looking at it like, this is so played out.
Yeah, there's a grubby side to it too.
You know what I mean? And don't get me wrong, I'm not against people making the best of what they have to make money and have success in life. But if you have the microphone and you're talking to the world, and I'm talking to the world right now, like, surely overcome your lesser characteristics to be the better person to have a decent effect on the world.
Yeah, and offer some value beyond your own ego, really.
Yeah, yeah. Other than who's the king of the jerks.
Yeah,
validate me. I got a bigger jerk belt than you. Like, okay, that's fine. You know, so that's why I feel like that's a big change in me, that, like, I don't care about championships anymore. Like, the people who inspire me are the people who went outside themselves and they weren't just trying to sit inside a competition because it's not about competition. That's to me, that's the paradigm shift that's occurred.
Beautiful.
That is fantastic, mate. I love it. I love it. We've got a couple more questions for you. We need to be a little bit time conscious. But you've been involved in a bunch of other stuff as well, which we haven't really touched on. You did a stint with NICA, the Circus Arts Institute.
I can't say I did a stint. That's not entirely true. Look, I first learned about Nike a couple of years ago because I went to their end of year performance.
Yeah.
And that was like really impressive and inspiring. And then I guess I've always been interested in trying to push body to different levels, and I found out that they had some, I accidentally walked in on the competitive men's gymnastics team training. I was like, oh, is this where people do gymnastics? And they were like, get out. Like, don't even walk in here. I was like, oh, sorry. My bad. Yeah. But no, I've been along to a few of the open training sessions.
Yep.
And not consistently, but definitely having met people there. And it's because I was always interested in kind of hip-hop culture and b-boying, and I always wanted to be able to kind of break dance, and so I was always mucking around with that kind of stuff. For me, it's more like a body control, physical control. Look, I think gymnastics is real popular right now. It's really trendy right now, so I don't really... That's not my biggest interest. I think handstanding is not going to teach you to fight. Like, as trendy as it is, I'd rather spend my time learning a skill which specific moves my body as opposed to not moving my body.
Mm.
Don't get me wrong, it's really hard. My man Dave Davey, king of handstands, shout out Dave Davey at Dave Davey, the handstand king. He's an amazing athlete. That guy has one of the best vertical jumps I've ever seen. He's incredibly explosive. And the guy can balance on one hand for days at a time. But I don't think it's that helpful. If you're living in North Fitzroy and you have a handlebar moustache and possibly some wood grain sunglasses and you own a French bulldog, possibly it's very practical to life. But if you need to punch someone in the fucking face, you need to stand on your 2 feet and get real strong and powerful at that.
Yeah.
Like,
truth.
What am I going to tell you?
Could not agree more.
So anyway, don't get me wrong. The guys at Nike are amazing. I went there. It was super impressive. I think we can learn so much from the gymnastics community. Coach Summer's stuff's amazing. I mean, look, Ido's stuff's amazing. But does that mean he's a great person to hang out with? Not necessarily. Like, this is my only thing with SNC communities, is a lot of people get to a certain level and then they just go full jerk mode. And look, I've tried many things. I've done Olympic lifting. I've done a lot of stuff. And I think what I've learned more and more is you're trying to get better at a sport. Focus on your sport and then make sure what you're doing outside of your sport enables you to do it better.
Enhances.
Yep. That's it.
Yep.
Like, you shouldn't be learning a whole other sport to enhance your sport. Like, that's right. This is a common mistake, and there's probably not enough people out there saying, yeah, probably don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a common thing to see Olympic lifts, you know, fighters starting to learn Olympic lifts from scratch, you know, leading up to some really important event. Mm. That is such a resource-heavy undertaking. Oh. It's so much time, so much taxing. Repetition.
So skill-specific.
Yeah, so much fine motor skill. I mean, I couldn't agree more. Less of that stuff, more of the stuff that's going to make you actually better at your sport. Which leads me on to my next question. I want to go back to exactly what elements, you know, from the circus arts and from the gymnastics and the movement culture, exactly what from those fields did you find translated or funneled best into strength and conditioning for fight athletes?
Well, I think I've been fortunate enough because I did Taekwondo for a lot of years. I had a lot of flexibility coming in, had a lot of good base leg strength and agility because that's mainly what we did.
Winning.
Yeah. I was obsessed with just core training, everything to do with the core, lateral, transverse, rotational, you name it. I wanted to get a strong core because I was a little fat kid with no abs.
Yep.
So I probably spent most of my teen years doing a billion sit-ups until I learned that you don't need to do a billion sit-ups to have a strong midsection. And then when I started to look at advanced training through gymnastics and like front levers and leg raises and like planching and that kind of thing, I was like, right, I'll get into that. I think the thing that gave me the biggest impact was when I first started doing kettlebell training.
Right.
So I started doing kettlebell training, my goodness, it's like 10 years ago, 2007. And I started training with Efim Kurubatsky, who was a physical trainer in the Russian military back in the Cold War era, fighting the Americans. And he also played ice hockey. He's Belarusian. He's from Belarus. He played ice hockey to a very high level. And man, the guy's you know, in his 50s, in immaculate condition, even though he's had a lot of injuries. And he was exposed to the Russian periodization. And they did a lot of hardcore, crazy shit to the soldiers. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's where they really got a lot of base. They're like, okay, we're going to push this training to the absolute limit. Oh, we killed him. Okay, we'll dial it back 10% and then give that to the athletes. Like, you know, because that's, hey, you know, not many countries had that liberty.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from him. He's a mentor of mine. I've just recently started back training with him, working on just getting stronger and approaching things differently. And look, the kettlebells just blew my mind in terms of grip, core, like loaded conditioning, complexes. Like, I mean, I think the depth of which I learned there was more like broader understanding of training, not just kettlebells. I think for a time I was like obsessed, and then I learned, you know, it's a tool just like any tool. It's only as good as you know how to use it and finding the right tool for the right job. You know, the barbell, that has its place in a certain way. Dumbbell has its place. Kettlebell has its place. Now, obviously, different S&Cs have their own opinions and their own takes on it. But I think for me, whenever I'm looking at a jiu-jitsu athlete, the two things I try and, like, if I want to get them better faster, if I've only got 8 weeks, grip and core. Like, if I can improve those two things, things are going to get dramatically better.
There's a lot of ground.
Yeah. And I think you could say that about any athlete, because that's going to dictate a lot more about shoulder. That's going to dictate a lot more about pelvic stability. You know, the whole deal. So I think looking at some of those top jiu-jitsu guys, a lot of people don't know, they're black belts in judo. They're also 15 years in capoeira. So they're basically gymnasts anyway.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, you're like, wow, how does he have so much balance? How do you just do a head spring? Yeah, he's a ninja. he's a capoeira Shaolin monk. You didn't know. Okay, well, that's your problem. So That's the thing. I think gymnastic elements are very helpful. But I think also because you're working with an opponent, you need to be able to exact force or exert force against an external element. Mm-hmm. Just controlling your body is not enough. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's great. Yes, you can get so strong doing it. But like until you've had someone who's like 40 kilos heavier than you breaking your posture down, if you don't know what that's like,
what's the name of the game in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, like you've got to really be so strong in your posterior chain, and just doing jiu-jitsu isn't going to teach you that.
But surely, if you're doing the gymnastic stuff concurrently with your regular jiu-jitsu training or whatever, these static positions, controlling your own body weight is going to translate into, you know, your strength and your controlling an opponent on the mat, right?
No. I don't agree with that. Yes, I think you need a degree of asymmetric strength. I think you need to be able to control certain positions, but you don't see guys in jiu-jitsu planching, sim sprawling. You know what I mean? Mm. I think the power, like if I had a choice, if I was going to say to a grappler, you want to get better, you got two choices. You can train gymnastics or wrestling. Go train wrestling.
Mm.
Like, duh. Like, you can learn to hold still real good, or you can learn to attack relentlessly, mm-hmm. fill your muscles full of lactate, and be explosive as fuck. Oh my goodness, there you go. Boom. That's what you need. Like, honestly, holding still is only good for photos. Like,
but like, you're saying there's absolutely no transfer.
I'm not saying that. But I'm saying just because someone's great gymnast doesn't mean they're going to be good at jiu-jitsu. Yeah.
So, like, so what you're saying the same thing. You can derive better value from a more efficient, optimal means elsewhere.
Look, how much time you
got? Skill-specific. Exactly.
Well, I mean, you tell me. Like, okay, so I'm an opinionated bastard. Yep. I'm going to say all kinds of things. You're much nicer human individual, Brenton.
Thank you.
Definitely the lighter side of the yin and the yang. and that's not just because you're fine, light complexion.
This is awesome. I love
right,
it.
Right now, if I was going to say to you, like, look, this is just you, man. Don't even worry about me, because I'm talking about. Look, I'll ask you the question, and I'm going to support it with something. So,
role reversal here.
Yeah, yeah. But if I was going to say to you, look, you can only train jiu-jitsu 3 times a week.
Yeah,
and you have 3 other sessions that you can play within the week, and you have obviously limited time, you work, you do everything, and you need to improve your comp game, not just improve your jiu-jitsu, you know, jiu-jitsu lifestyle. and your options are CrossFit, gymnastics, or wrestling.
Easy choice. Wrestling, the skills and techniques and I guess the mechanical movements of wrestling are so fundamental to jiu-jitsu already that you're already going to get that crossover and that transferable benefit.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a no-brainer.
And I think if we look at possibly the first, I'll probably get this wrong, but this blew my mind. When Team Lloyd Irvin, I can't remember if they won or they got second in the team trophy for the World No-Gi Championships. Mm-hmm. This is when JT Torres and Keenan and all the guys were competing there. And even himself, Lloyd Irvin won the heavyweight masters. Or I can't remember what it was, right? First American team to ever do it. They got, I think, second in the team trophy, right? That's crazy.
It's insane.
They did that in the shortest amount of time. You know where they got that from? Wrestling and judo. They didn't get it from jiu-jitsu. Like, yeah, they have great jiu-jitsu, but it's that attacking decisiveness. Jiu-jitsu is the marathon. Judo is the 100-meter sprint.
Yep.
Mm. You know, and that's really where Lloyd came from. And that's also his team. If you look at the way they train, they have quite good S&C. Like, they have brutal, brutal conditioning, and they go super hard, and it's all about that explosiveness and that toughness. And I observed that, and I went, you got to pay attention to that.
Mm.
You know, if these guys are beating the Brazilians, how are they doing it? And they weren't doing it by focusing just on jiu-jitsu. And they definitely were not doing planches or handstands.
Mm-hmm. Try and argue with that, Brenton.
Hey, I'm on board. I completely agree.
That's great. That's fantastic.
I'm a fan of JT, so.
Oh, anyway, all I was going to say is this. Look, in a fight, who's going to, like, we can just look at the, you know, when they have the disciplines in cage fighting, you know, and MMA, they go, this guy is a NCAA champion wrestler. This guy is an Olympic gymnast. No. Yeah. Where are you, Olympic gymnast? Where are you? You're nowhere. You're too busy at Nike. No, I'm kidding. I love you. Much respect. It's a miserable life, and then you get no love, and then you blow out and get fat.
So I guess as, just to sort of start to close this podcast out, one of the final questions I'll ask is, can you name for us an inspiring figure? Who, why, and how did you arrive at this choice, and what have you learned from him or her that's made such a difference in your life, and perhaps give us an example of a lesson that has actually improved your life? You've touched on Marcus Aurelius, so you've gone down that stoicism path with meditations and...
I had a lot of really good teachers, so To narrow it down to one person is really tough because I have so many good role models around me. Like, I learned so much from everybody. Is this like, I guess, can I just slightly ask on the question? Is it just within jiu-jitsu or within strength conditioning or like both, or what's the...
Let's go down the path of
categorize it, if you like.
Okay, so name for me one person in terms of philosophy. I'll say one person philosophy, strength conditioning, and jiu-jitsu.
I think one of the biggest influences on me is we need to do another podcast for me to be able to put everyone else out there. I think philosophically, one of the people who helped change my mind about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is Fabio Gurgel. Now, the reason I'm going to say Fabio right now is because he is the most successful coach of all time in terms of having produced the most champions, but also he's been quite resilient, because you've got to think he gave birth to all the major players of all the major teams from the 90s when Allianz split. Then he had to recoup and rebuild a new stable of champions from the 2000s, like when GB was dominating. And then he did. And he produced Cabrinha. And he produced Marcelo. And then he produced all these other guys, right? It's crazy. But I was really fortunate. I got to sit down with him before he was getting ready for his fights with Mario Sperry. And yeah, I got to
ADCC super fight.
ADCC super fight, yeah. And it was really fortunate for me because I got to actually sit on the mat and just chat with him. But also at that time, I got to do a couple of private lessons with him when he used to do that. He doesn't really do private lessons anymore. So that's really fortunate. And when you talk to a guy like that who's been there from kind of conception, like very early on through to now, and he's still in it. Look, he just said some really interesting things to me. And what he said echoed the words of other really influential, smart people outside of jiu-jitsu. And he said, techniques are many, principles are few. He said, there's a lot of people coming out with the hot technique, or this is cool, that's cool, but they don't know why they're doing it. Where does that fit into the broader understanding of why are you doing what the hell you're doing? And he was saying even the structure of competition jiu-jitsu was not right. Because he said, that's not jiu-jitsu. That's BJJ. That's IBJJF, you know, like IFBJJ. He was saying the heart of jiu-jitsu is no time limit, submission only. And he was saying this before the recent submission
the
only stuff.
He
was saying this 6 years ago. I think he's always said this. And they do that occasionally at the team. And I mean, I'm not saying this because I'm biased, because there's plenty of people out there who don't love Fabio. But, you know, he's a really tough man. But I'm very fortunate. I've got to just sit down and I just said to him, man, what makes a great academy? And he said, it shouldn't be a gym. It should be a school. Mm. It's about learning. And it's about the team. And he explained why they do closeouts. Because they used to really piss me off. I was like, man, how good would it be to see like Lucas Leprey fight Michael Lange? Like, that would be sick. That would be the best. But he said, you know what? I don't care about the world. I don't care what the world wants to see. I care about my team. These guys have to trust each other 100%. That's why they're never going to fight in competition. Because that way they don't hold anything back in competition, in training. They don't keep a technique up their sleeve like, I'm going to use that just on the guy in the comp, you know? Because they'll never fight, you know? And that's a massive thing there. Like, that you are so close to that guy. He's your brother. You can't fight him. It's against the code of the team. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. And he's like, it actually cultivates better learning because everyone trusts each other, everyone shares, everyone gets that much better. And all I care about is my team and stuff everybody else. And look, you can say that's wrong or that's right, but that was like family talk, real talk, and that was really interesting to me. And just being able to sit with a guy like that who's lived the history of jiu-jitsu, talk about training with Hickson, you know, knowing Helio, and like, it's crazy. It's crazy because that guy is still current.
Where did Fabio get his black belt from?
So Jacare, the original.
Not Sousa.
No. Romero Cover Country.
Yeah.
He's the head of a Lions team. He gave him his black belt. And so under all the lineages, he's like second generation. So second, like first generation, second generation under kind of Gracie lineage. It's the thing. He stayed current. He's kept producing champions up to this point in time, you know. Yeah. And he's really lucky. He's got the biggest team going around, so they kind of take care of themselves. I think it's one of those things that he really cares about the art of jiu-jitsu, and he cares about the heart of learning what it means to be a part of something bigger.
Yeah.
And I think I took that away, and it blew my mind because I didn't expect that. And he was so generous with his information. You know, that was awesome, and it was just influenced me to understand that, like, this thing, even though it seems very esoteric and weird, like many things in life, is really powerful, bringing people together. And, you know, here we are now, many years later, hanging out, chatting in this way.
Excellent.
Philosophy?
Oh, man. Look, I think philosophically, a person had massive influence on me I think Bruce Lee is probably my biggest influence in life, because he was really good at taking something that was kind of a bit to the side and making it very real in life. Mm-hmm. So he translated a lot of Eastern philosophy and brought it to life. And you know, he, as I'm sure plenty of people know, but he said, all knowledge ultimately means self-knowledge. So when you learn something, when you do something, you learn something about yourself. Every time you do something, you learn something about yourself, even though you may not see it in that way. And he said his ultimate goal in his life, he didn't say this in an interview, he said it in his book, was to know himself. And he hoped by the end of his life, he would come to know who he was. And really, I try to apply that myself. And I feel like I probably already got it. Not like I'm not changing or I'm developing. I already kind of figured out what I feel I want to be and how I'm working towards it pretty early on, because I'm pretty fortunate to be exposed to that knowledge early on, whereas lots of people just got exposed to Home and Away early on.
Mm.
And so they weren't deep in martial arts philosophy from a young age, you know, and I've been in martial arts since I was 10 and a half years old. So looking up to that, reading all of his books, listening to all his interviews, and just constantly trying to expand my understanding, like that's really helped me cultivate a philosophy.
Excellent.
Amazing.
Thanks for coming on, JT. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. Gentlemen, I appreciate you having me here. I wish I could have shared more ridiculous anecdotal stories, as I have lots of them, maybe at a later time.
Absolutely. Mate, save up those stories, because we'll have a part two to this for sure.
Oh, that'd be cool. All right, thank you for having me.
Been a pleasure having you on, brother.
I appreciate it.
Awesome as always. Thank you, JT.
All right, guys, take care.